Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good afternoon. Welcome along to Premier Christian Radio Unbelievable between now and 4 o'clock. Don't forget, from 4, Dave and Bea are here with Hip Rock UK. And from 6 o'clock this evening, you can hear the best unsigned Christian music talent. But that's all to come right now. It's the show where Christians and non-Christians get together to talk a fascinating discussion for you on today's program. You're unbelievable. We're asking a fairly fundamental question. Did Jesus actually exist? Well, someone who contends that he did not is super skeptic Ken Humphreys. He's going to be explaining his views, and countering them will be JP Holding. He's a US apologist. I met him through an internet site called Theology Web, and he's going to be explaining why he thinks that's just taking skepticism beyond the bounds of reality to suggest that Jesus didn't even exist. It's a fascinating discussion. Hope you can join me right through till 4 o'clock this afternoon. We look forward to meeting our guests shortly. Before we get to them, some reflection on the last few weeks of programming. Lots and lots of response to various different topics that we've been featuring on the show in the last few weeks. Thanks to those who've been getting in touch about other things such as our Christian and Islam resources. Richard wanted to know whether it's possible to download the Up the Ladder in Hyde Park special documentary I did about the debates that go on in Hyde Park between Christians and Muslims. That is available, Richard, on the Unbelievable webpage as a feature. You can't, as it were, download it as an MP3 file to take away with you, but you can listen to it there on the webpage, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. You say that you're just starting to enter into dialogues and debates with Muslims out there in Dallas in Texas in the hope they would hear and believe the truth and be saved. And Jay Smith and others are a fountain of knowledge. Any websites or any other info concerning apologists specializing in Islam would be greatly, greatly appreciated. Richard, I'm sure that, if you go to Answering Islam, that's another site where those kinds of debates and articles are featured. I'm sure you've discovered that for yourself, though. Art in Washington is another person who's been enjoying the program. He's an atheist, though, or agnostic at least. You say, I am an atheist, perhaps an agnostic. I was raised in a religious home and educated in Christian high school and college. I study religion regularly, and although I am an agnostic, I regularly listen to and read apologetics materials. While I disagree with you and your religious guests, I think your show is the best I've heard. I regularly hear you and contributors to your show talk of the importance of a relationship with Jesus. I also hear big name apologists admit to periods of time in which they experienced doubt. Well, that raises a question about whether the personal relationship with Jesus is a relationship with a real person or with an imaginary friend. And you go on to give the analogy of, if you're talking to your wife, you have no doubt of a relationship there. She exists. There'd never be any need to doubt it. You say, I would not need to gather with a group of others every Sunday to try and convince myself that she really exists and that I know her. It's a very interesting aspect of the whole faith aspect, I suppose. You don't call it faith unless at some level there is the ability to doubt. You can't have faith without doubt on the other side, as it were, to make it faith. Not sort of within the scope of me to answer those questions now, but if anyone else has a suggestion that they'd like to put forward, I'd welcome that. You can always email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. I might feature your letter as well on the Unbelievable page of the Premier community there, Art, if you don't mind, because I think there's some interesting issues you raise there, and it'd be interesting to hear responses there. So do check that out if you want to look into that more at premier.org.uk/unbelievable and click on through to the Premier community. But lots of other responses coming in, particularly in regard to the programme we did 2 weeks ago now with Terry Sanderson of the National Secular Society. We were asking, are Christians being marginalised? It was part of our I Am a Christian campaign. Still, you're able to go online and declare your faith as a Christian as part of Premier's campaign at iamachristian.org.uk. But firstly, here's some more of your phone responses.
Good afternoon. My name is Faith. I feel the chaplaincy shouldn't be removed from the hospitals. I've benefited from that as a patient. Eventually, I became a volunteer. Eventually, I got employed. But I've still continued to benefit from the chaplaincy team, because where we deliver services to the patient, the patients are getting extremely stressed as well because of so many reasons and factors that we don't always know, but have to encounter and support them in healing and everything that happens. I feel we need that support from the chaplains, and the staff need them and the patients need them.
Hello, my name's Susan. I was speaking to a vicar who, a young man went to see her saying that he'd gone to get a curse put on someone, and the person who was going to put the curse on this friend of his, so-called friend, said that he couldn't touch him because he already had the sign of the cross on him. I just wonder if people know about the power of the cross. And also, I'd like to say, I've been told I'm going in for an operation this week, and they just don't know what could happen. I just couldn't imagine going in and not having a chaplain there.
Hello, Justin. This is Christopher Elston from Košice. That's how you pronounce this town in eastern Slovakia. I was listening to the program on Saturday. Terry Sanderson's perceived offence, and that of those like him, at merely being asked if he'd like to be prayed for, must it deny others who'd welcome it the opportunity to be prayed for? His pointless selfishness would deprive everyone of the opportunity to receive prayer at critical and not so critical times of their lives.
Hello, yeah, I'm just phoning up about the secularist today. I believe in God, I trust in God, and I love God, and I really don't want anyone to perish. But in his case, I'd be prepared to let him go to hell, because he's so intolerant of everybody. So intolerant, he doesn't know what it is that he's saying. All right, thanks. Bye.
Well, thank you for getting in touch. By email, Bobby to Terry of the Secular Society says, a key question, do those who call themselves Christian have views? If the laws of the land deprive Christians from holding and expressing such views, is that fair? The summary of Terry's participation in your programme is to clearly state that Christians should not be heard or permitted to share and defend their views. Tony, the atheist from Essex, says, I just wanted to comment on Saturday's show, asking whether Christians are being marginalised. It was a fascinating topic, but I felt was spoilt by Andrea Williams far too often either interrupting or just plain talking over Terry Sanderson when he was merely trying to express his views. I thought Terry did a good job of remaining calm, despite Andrea's determination to get her points heard the most and the loudest. Regarding the discussion points, am I safe to assume that, Andrea, that should you or a Christian loved one ever be in a vulnerable position through illness or unfortunate circumstances, you'd have no objection if a Muslim nurse or care worker were to offer to talk about Muhammad or pray to Allah, or an atheist were to offer to tell you about the lack of an afterlife, or a Satan worshipper were to offer to summon the devil to save you if you give a piece of your soul, just as each of these would be completely inappropriate, as those personal beliefs have nothing to do with their jobs, so the same applies to Christians. I find it rather troubling that neither you nor Andrea seem to understand why this would be inappropriate. Richard Scott Watson, on the other hand, says, What a fascinating discussion. What Terry actually says when he says people confuse secularism and atheism, what he actually means was that what he was dressing up, fundamentalist atheism, as nice cuddly secularism and expecting us just to accept it. When he said he was entirely happy with people's personal religion, what he actually meant is that all forms of religion or faith will only be tolerated in his secular society if they are invisible and have no impact on society. The fact that they built the society, laws, hospitals, schools, etc., he sees as only an inconvenient part of history. He fails to realise, or maybe just to admit, that he is a follower of one of the most intolerant religions of all. I must say, I felt really sorry for him. If his life consists of trying to force his very narrow-minded views down other people's throats, he really can't have much of a life, says Richard. Peter was incensed at what Terry had to say, Peter in Dartford. He says, I just wish to make a brief comment. The secular agenda is not just to restrict expressions as Christianity, but confine it totally to the private sphere so that it has no public outlet. This is the suppression of free speech and needs those of all faiths to resist it, says Peter in Dartford. Thank you very much for a variety of responses to that programme. Still available to listen to that programme with Terry Sanderson of the National Secular Society and Andrea Williams of Christian Concern for Our Nation, asking, are Christians being marginalised? That's available now at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Don't forget, you can also get us via podcast now. You can get there, sign up to the podcast. You can go to iTunes via a link on the page there as well. It's all possible. And last week's programme on euthanasia, also available. So let's just hear some of your responses. We had last week Lord Dick Taverne, an atheist, and Dan Boucher of the Christian charity CARE, talking about whether euthanasia should be legalised. Some very emotional responses to that particular topic.
I was staggered to listen to Lord Taverne talking about people dying with dignity and strong-minded people deciding to commit suicide, and a relative of mine was murdered. It's called euphemistically involuntary euthanasia, in order that another relative could inherit a great deal of money from him, and this would also save nursing home fees. And he was deprived of effective nourishment for the last few months of his life, and eventually died because this relative denied him any liquid intake for 5 days. And he died. He did not want to die. He lived for 5 days with no water. He was given morphine, and he died. And the reality is in this country is that hundreds, and I would suggest thousands of people, are killed at the moment in this way. To make this legal would be utterly wrong.
I mean, I do resent the comments what the politician is saying, because I've had personal experience where my father was seriously ill and dying in hospital. Basically, the consultant was literally trying to encourage my father to commit suicide. They will stop his treatment and he will have a coma and he will pass away peacefully. My dad at the time was overdosed with morphine, but luckily he had a little bit of sense left and was able to understand what the consultant is saying and say, well, you know what, I do not wish to commit suicide. And so the bottom line is, I do resent and I'm passionate against assisted dying, because sometimes people are being coerced into killing themselves. So I do resent when politicians who do not have no real life experience speak up on the behalf of other people who have practical experience.
Hi, I'm Johnson. If you're looking at a man has a combination of physical and a spiritual being, as a Christian I do believe strongly that when the physical comes to an end, there is another state that we enter into which goes on and on and on, for which you're accountable to God. So on those grounds I would say that euthanasia is wrong, both on the part of the recipient, who, if they agree to it, and also the person that administers it, obviously, because they're taking life into their own hands and saying that we can end it at will. Thank you.
Well, thanks for those phone responses to the euthanasia topic on last week's programme. Again, if you want to listen back to that, it's available now at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And why not discuss it on the Premier community? It's a place where lots of people are joining the Unbelievable group to discuss these sorts of programmes. premier.org.uk www.vatican.org/unbelievable. Well, we're going to meet our guests now. We're going to be talking about whether Jesus really existed.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, welcome along to the programme. Really interesting programme for you today as we address a very large question, a very interesting question. Did Jesus exist? We're looking at the evidence for and against. In some ways, some people may be scratching their head and saying, well, of course he existed. Surely that's not in question. But we have a person here in the studio today who does dispute the idea that Jesus ever even existed. He is Ken Humphreys. He's been on the show a couple of times before. He's an atheist. He's a critic of Christianity. And, well, he's been pretty staunch and outspoken in his criticism of the Bible, its history, of Christian history. He's debated Gary Habermas on the resurrection not so long ago. So it should be a pretty interesting tussle as he meets, coming on the phone from the States, J.P. Holding. JP is a Christian apologist, and his Tectonics Apologetics Ministry describes itself as the hardest-hitting apologetics ministry on the web, answering Bible difficulties and contradictions. And, well, if you go to tectonics.org, Tectonics, they're spelt with a K, tectonics.org, you'll find a wealth of articles, information and research that JP has put together in regards to the historical reliability of the Bible and the resurrection and many other themes besides. So welcome, gentlemen, both to the programme.
Good morning, Justin.
Good to have you both with us. Well, it is morning, certainly, for JP in the States. So thanks for joining us at this time of the morning, JP. Tell us a little bit about yourself, JP, because... You are quite a fascinating character. You seem to provoke strong reactions from those that you have dealings with on the internet. Tell us a little bit about why that might be.
I suppose that's fair to say. It is, as you say, because I try to maintain the hardest-hitting apologetics website on the internet. And one particular commentator referred to me as the Ann Coulter of apologetics, and I think that's pretty fair to say.
I'm not familiar. Maybe that's an American personality, but Ann Coulter, what is significant about Ann Coulter?
Ann Coulter is a political personality over here, very conservative, writes many books, and does a lot of commentary on the policies over here in our government.
I see. So you, if you like, represent a very firm, if you like, position, and a kind of a no-holds-barred, if you'll forgive the pun, sort of approach to debating. You're not afraid of using a bit of rhetoric, throwing out a few, you know, word forms that, you know, you might not find in a strict debating kind of atmosphere.
Yeah, I enjoy my craft. In a situation like this, though, we really won't have time for me to enjoy my craft.
No, indeed. Well, we'll have to use our time wisely, obviously. Tell us a bit about your background, though, JP. What got you interested in this whole field in the first place?
Well, oddly enough, I was raised in a New Age sort of cult religion, and I was told repeatedly that Christianity was intolerant and undesirable, and the only Christians I knew validated that claim. However, I eventually looked into it myself and made my own decision. And that's where I stand now. I've been interested in apologetics since the age of 15 or 16, and I've been practicing it somewhat ever since. That's about 25 years now.
And obviously, since the dawn of the internet, you've been using that medium to bring your message across. I mean, what kinds of debates do you get involved in? I mean, I know that you post on forums, you obviously update, etc. I mean, do you find that this kind of arena is helpful, is kind of breaking ground in terms of bringing the gospel to people who would otherwise be closed to it?
Oh, to a goodly extent it is. In more recent times, I've taken more to publishing of educational materials and going to look more into production of other kinds of educational materials, such as video productions and that sort of thing. I am on the Theology Web Forum, and I don't spend as much time there as I used to, simply because I've run into all these arguments before, and there's really no need for me to spend time reiterating them with the same people or with different people who bring up the same arguments again and again. And so I've somewhat changed my orientation in the last few years, and that's going to be something that's going to continue.
Okay. I mean, as to the whole question of Jesus' existence, I mean, where does this sit for you in terms of the objections you come across? Is this one of the most unrealistic type of criticisms that you face as far as you're concerned?
I think it would be fair to say that it is. I place it on the same standard, and I'm going to use the acronym JNE to refer to that thesis as it is held by whether Ken or by anyone else, not him in particular. And I place it roughly on the same level as those who say that Shakespeare didn't write his plays or that the World Trade Center disaster was an engineered disturbance.
You think it's on the level of that kind of conspiracy type of
I would say so.
Theory.
I would say it's not a responsible use of historical methodology, but rather it's one in which special pleading and raising of the bar on standards is the norm.
Okay, interesting, and we'll probably get to have a look at that whole idea of whether Ken is asking for a realistic standard of historical evidence in the course of his criticisms. Thank you, JP, for being with us on the programme
Sure.
today, and we look forward to your contribution. Ken Humphreys, as I said, is our other guest, and Ken, JesusNeverExisted.com, that's the fairly clear title
yep.
of your website. You published a book to the same name, and
indeed,
you have all manner of articles and features on that website.
It's an ongoing project, that's for sure.
Tell us a bit of your background then. Did you come out of a religious upbringing and
well,
turn
no,
to atheism?
I can share that much with you. I grew up in a tough working class neighbourhood in which religion really didn't have much of a role to play. Notionally, my mother was Church of England, but that really didn't have any implications. My father was an agnostic, and so I grew up with very little obligations towards religion and failed to be convinced by it when I became aware of it. What did happen, of course, it, from a historical point of view, it did capture my interest. You know, the fact that there were organised religions in the world and they made various claims did fascinate me, and it's been a lifelong interest. Now, most of my life, of course, I haven't been able to pursue that in any great detail, but I certainly have in the last 10, 12 years, and I've made a particular study of the Christian religion. I mean, it does make pretty bold claims, more so than any conventional history, and therefore one does have a certain approach to it that perhaps what you wouldn't apply to Shakespeare or the demolition of the Twin Towers in New York. If it makes such claims that God interfered in the human history, then one really needs convincing evidence that that's so, and not simply possibly it might have happened.
Well, I remember the first time I had you on the programme, a lot of people in response said, What's his problem, basically? They assumed that there must be some kind of grudge, there must be some kind of reason for you to spend all this time and effort on trying to demolish the faith of Christians. I mean, do you have something against Christians
and
their faith?
Let me answer that one, because it comes up so much in emails and from the sort of comments I get from Christians who rarely can tackle anything of a historical nature. They do make that sort of personal slight that the suggestion that I've been hurt or damaged in my life by Christians. Now, I've just explained, I grew up without any particular acquaintance with Christians as such. I certainly wasn't hurt by any. I wasn't molested by priests. I had no particular issue with them, but the nature of religion, as someone drawn as a child towards understanding history, and particularly ancient history, religion as a topic engaged my interest. It is fascinating. So set aside the fact whether Jesus existed or not, and I think we can establish quite clearly he didn't, you know, the evolution of that religion through its various ages and its engagement with mankind is fascinating. Everything's there. I love the popes. What a wonderful study they are. You know, there is so much to engage one's interest. You don't need a psychological explanation as if it's some sort of deviant behaviour pattern. It's a pity more Christians don't study their own history.
Well, we are going to have a fascinating discussion between my two guests because they both hold, if you like, strident ways of putting their arguments across. I mean, it's fair to say that, JP, your website pulls no punches and the way you do your debating. I'd say the same is true very much in some ways of Ken. Your website and the tone of the book that you wrote on Jesus Never Existed is, in a sense, somewhat polemical. There are touches of, you know, satire or you know, humour, obviously, directed at Christians and their beliefs. But nonetheless, I think this is just a very interesting aspect of this whole thing, and I'm happy for you guys. I think it's a good matching here between yourself, Ken, and JP. So we'll look at with great interest at this debate. Did Jesus exist? Ken Humphreys says no. JP Holding says, of course he did, and I'll show you why. We're going to be looking at primarily whether there are contemporaneous witnesses to Jesus' existence, whether it's more than just the Bible said it, I believe it, whether we can look both within and without the Bible at the evidence for Jesus' existence, and we'll probably get onto some other aspects of this as well in the course of the programme. So do hope you can stay with me for this programme as we look at the evidence for the existence of Jesus with JP Holding.
This podcast is an outreach of Premier Insight, and it's made possible through the support of listeners like you. And your support today is so vital. We want to thank you for your generous gift by giving you exclusive access to Science, Faith and the Evidence for God apologetics course. This 9-module course invites you to learn from John Lennox, one of the most celebrated Christian thinkers of our time, through conversations with atheist thinker Michael Ruse and secular talk show host Dave Rubin. You'll be empowered to confidently speak into conversations on faith, science, and why believing in God is not only reasonable, but logical. The course is free to you to thank you for your gift to help Premier Insight equip more Christians to confidently speak into the biggest issues of our culture and defend their Christian faith with conviction and grace. To get access to Science, Faith, and the Evidence for God, simply go to premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Unbelievable show. Thank you for your support.
And Ken Humphreys.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the programme. Really interesting discussion topic today. Did Jesus exist? Well, you may say, surely that is perfectly obvious that he existed. Isn't the question more around things like whether he was raised from the dead? Well, there are people who are more sceptical than that, I can tell you. One of them is Ken Humphreys, who's the author of the website JesusNeverExisted.com. As he said, he, if you like, represents the somewhat more radical edge of historical analysis in terms of his actual denial of the very existence of the man Jesus. And we'll be finding out from him in due course why he doesn't believe there was an actual historical person called Jesus who did the things recorded in the Gospels and etc. So JP Holding, Christian apologist, countering that and bringing his evidence for the existence of Jesus. Indeed, he brings evidence for the resurrection as well if you visit his website, tectonics.org. So before we come to JP, Ken, you know, most people would say, what are you going on about? Jesus never existed. I mean, surely that's fairly indisputable, isn't it?
Well, let's take that point. Let's deal with this one up front in an honest fashion. Most people in this world would agree that Jesus existed. I have no question with that. They will say, if asked, of course he existed. If you then ask them to say, well, explain how you know that, I think then you would discover they begin to a little bit in trying to establish it. Because the fact of the matter is, the overwhelming majority of believers in the historical Jesus simply assume he existed. And Not only do believers assume he existed, so do many scholars, and I've read many of their books. You can open them, and on page one, in paragraph one, they will make a declaration about the existence of Jesus. This is before they write anything investigating it. They will say Jesus was, Jesus did. Now, that is the problem that has to be stated up front. We cannot say Jesus existed simply because a lot of ill-informed people who have been socialized into a belief system simply go along with that notion and assume Jesus existed. I'm saying if there was such a character, let's look at what evidence we can find to substantiate that. And that's where the problems begin. And it's not just myself. For 200 years, scholars have gone down that path and thought, my gosh, there is no evidence here for the historical Jesus. And at that point, the wagons get circled.
OK, just maybe pinpoint what these things are then that these scholars would come across, things that suggest there really is no evidence for.
Well, the point is, if we are trying to establish a bona fide character as opposed to the probabilities of a character, then that is very different. You know, of course there were people called Jesus in first century Judea. You know, and Galilee. You know, there's no question about that. You only have to take the fact that if the population of the country was about 500,000 and Jesus probably was the name held by about 4% of them, then you've probably got 10,000 people called Jesus. Of course there were people called Jesus. I could sit here today and say there are people called Bob who live in Chicago. Not that I actually know any one of them that name. So this is simply the probabilistic likelihood of there being such a character. But if we are to believe the biblical story, we've got to go beyond that and find a particular Jesus that fits the bill.
I mean, and we'll let JP in on just a second, but just for those who are still scratching their head maybe and saying, but okay, well, what's wrong then with the gospel accounts? You know, why do you say that? Are you saying that they were made up? Are you saying that they were somehow sort of fables and came a long time later, that they were a composite of stories going around, none of which really had a basis in fact?
All of that, Justin, but I'll say it much more simply. Late and fake. That is what's wrong with the gospels. They are late and fake. And that's why I make my first point. There is a lack of contemporaneous witnesses. That is, people alive at the purported time of Jesus who recorded the fact. Now, I know, and JP won't surprise me with anything here, the only answer they can make if called upon to answer that very specific question is yes, but. That is the problem.
Okay.
I'm sure there isn't anyone lurking there.
It's a kind of, you know, you spelled it out in fairly general terms there. I'm sure we'll get into the particular issues as we go on. So, JP, your response to this late and fake and the fact that there are a lack of contemporaneous witnesses.
All right, well, let's make sure we understand the terms of what we're talking about here. I made a comparison to the thesis that Shakespeare didn't write his plays and the Trade Center disaster was engineered. And his response was the effect that this is different because we're talking about God interfering in human history. Well, God does not need to interfere in human history for there to be a historical founder of the Christian religion named Jesus who was crucified under Pilate. We're talking about two entirely separate issues here if we're going to get into did Jesus exist as a person versus did he do the things ascribed to him in the Gospels. I'm sticking here just for the purposes of debate with the issue, did this person simply exist, regardless of whether he did the miracles ascribed to him in the Gospels? Now, in terms of this issue of declarative statements being made by authorities, I found in my research that they make these declarative statements because they've already done the background research, and they don't see a need to reiterate it each time they write a new book. And it has been stressed again, as he noted, that many scholars agree with this view that Jesus existed, and he has alluded briefly to confessional interests. Now, I listened to the debate with Tony Costa, and he said, well, we would need to discuss why individual scholars who are not Christians continue to believe. In that case, one of my questions will be at some point, why does Bart Ehrman still believe in a historical Jesus if he is an agnostic? Now, finally, in terms of the main issue of contemporary witnesses, he says there's always a yes, but. Well, that doesn't matter if the but is a valid question. And in this case, I have a very valid point to make, which is that this idea that we have to have a contemporary witness is simply an invented rule. The Greek, I'm not even going to bother with the Gospels here as evidence. I'm going to stick solely with the testimony of Cornelius Tacitus, which I feel by itself, even if the Gospels disappeared, even if Josephus disappeared, would be more than sufficient to establish a historical Jesus existed. Now, Tacitus reports many events that were not contemporary to him, and yet I have yet to see anyone simply say, well, simply because he is not a contemporary, that means that we can't take what he says as true. The reason that historians don't mind taking it otherwise is because they know that Tacitus did research, that he was a very reliable historian, that he knew his business.
Just give us an idea of when was Tacitus living and recording in relation to Jesus?
It's kind of difficult to establish exact dates of birth and death, of course, but most people would say he's somewhere mid-first century is when he was born, say around the time of Nero or perhaps earlier, and that he died somewhere around 120, which would be the early 2nd century. Now, the life of Jesus, of course, would be somewhere around 4 BC to approximately maybe 33 AD, depending on what chronology you want to use. But obviously, they were not contemporaries.
Mm. So, but you're saying that's not really the issue. The fact is, he was his historian, and he applied the same historical methodology to Jesus as we trust him for with many other people that he writes about.
Precisely. And see, what I'm going to say is that any argument that anyone holding the J&E position, not necessarily Ken again, but just anyone, any argument that they will use to try and say a person named Jesus did not exist can be turned around just as readily and applied to say that, say, Gamaliel did not exist, that Socrates did not exist, and further along, the Holocaust did not happen, Shakespeare didn't write his plays, and so on. And that is because J&E at its heart requires simply special pleading, let's look at the evidence slightly differently for this or that reason, and so on.
So are you suggesting then that Ken is asking for greater historical proof for the existence of Jesus than he's actually would be asking for any other historical character?
That would be the case, and I'm not saying that he doesn't give some kind of reasons, because I did listen to the Costa debate. I know he gives certain reasons, such as, oh, they had confessional interest, but I'm saying that those additional reasons are simply contrived and inadequate, and that they are not fair play, shall we say.
So you're saying then, Ken, I mean, and JP here is referencing to some extent the debate you had about a year ago now with Ken Costa, Tony Costa.
Yeah.
The fact that, yes, the gospel writers, those witnesses, etc., had some kind of...
A vested interest.
Indeed, they did, yes. But that isn't particularly relevant, according to...
Well, no, but let's at least at this point in the debate acknowledge what I said would happen, that, you know, I made the point there is a lack of contemporaneous witnesses, and JP has agreed that, and he has said but. So I think you will acknowledge that far. It is exactly as I said. Now, okay, we have moved to Tacitus. So let's make it clear. We have moved to our first, and I presume our prime witness, to the early in the 2nd century. So this is where Christians turn for their first witness in the stand. Tacitus, writing probably around about the 110, 112, something like that. Now, as a preamble, let me first of all establish something about the behaviour of Christians during the period in which they transmitted to us Tacitus and every other source we have to rely upon, because we're in the unfortunate position now that our evidences have to be brought forward from the very people whose interest is to withhold information or to alter information. We don't have copies of Tacitus that have come to us without being passed through the Christian filter. Now, have we any reason to doubt the honesty of these Christians? Well, let me address that one very directly and say, yes, we can demonstrate in infinite detail how from the very beginning until the present day, Christians have lied and fabricated evidence. Now, where should we begin on that? We can begin with the very Apostle St. Paul, who actually warns the brethren in Thessalonica not to be deceived by a letter falsely written in his name. Now, whether that letter to Thessalonians is itself a forgery or not, either way, we have evidence here of fraud. That is at the beginning. Subsequently, we have correspondence fabricated between Seneca and the Apostle Paul. We have a fabricated letter apparently written by Jesus himself to the king of Edessa, and so on and so on. You know, Christianity is fraudulent in tooth and claw, and it goes all the way forward through the donation of Constantine, where the Pope claimed a right to the Western Empire, all the way through to the bone box of James, which was touted around a couple of years ago. So we have a source for Tacitus that is tainted by a long and unworthy record of forgery.
Okay, so the contention is then, JP, that your reliance on Tacitus's history is marred by the fact that it would have passed through Christians' hands who would have added to it, deleted from it. What do you make of that?
All right. Well, he says he's predicted a yes, but as I said, if it's a valid but, there's no reason to say that you've got anything on me there. Let's put it this way. As I said, we can use any argument like this to also disprove any other historical figure. I've done the same thing to disprove that Rabbi Gamaliel existed. All the testimony we have of him, except in the book of Acts, which we can discount automatically, of course, comes from the hand of Jews who wrote the Talmud. Well, they obviously had a very strong confessional interest in having a wonderful teacher like Gamaliel exist. It says, in fact, in the Torah, or in the Talmud, excuse me, when Gamaliel died, the honor of Torah ceased, and purity and piety became extinct. Well, obviously, Gamaliel must have been a rallying point used to keep Jewish persons in line after the troubling period after Bar Kokhba. I find many things suspicious about that. Gamaliel was such a wonderful Jewish leader, supposedly, but he's not mentioned by Josephus. Surely he would have recognized him as some kind of wonderful person if he actually existed. Now, you get my point here. I actually don't think that Gamaliel never existed. I agree that he did. But we can use these same kinds of reasoning to dispute and get rid of any historical figure. Charges of bias are very easy to make. Charges of confessional interest are very easy to make. And it's also very easy to arrive at guilt by association and say, well, because of one forgery, that means all these other things have been forged too. That's not how historians work. Now, he mentioned several different forgeries or claims of forgery. I have articles on each, but let me just briefly mention a couple of things that I would say in response to those. In terms of Thessalonians, I don't think there was a forged letter. I think Paul is saying that because the Thessalonians misunderstood his first letter, and he is thinking that perhaps someone wrote one in his name, and that is why they're confused about it. He is just making a guess. There was no actual forgery. In terms of the bone box of James, well, that's been looked at even more deeply. I understand that many of the authorities who declared originally a forgery have been debunked, but that's another issue, and we don't want to get into that too much detail, I would think. Things like the correspondence between Seneca and Paul. Well, I'm no too clear that these things were intended to be understood as forgeries as opposed to something like edifying fiction. I mean, we don't know exactly what the intent or purpose was with some of these documents. This would be like someone picking up a book by Marjorie Holmes, who is a writer of devotional fiction over here, and saying, well, this book, Two from Galilee, was a forgery intended to show history. I don't know that we can be sure that something like the correspondence between Paul and Seneca wasn't simply something theoretical that was put together to say, well, here's what would happen if this happened. Something like a Harry Turtledove novel. I don't know if you have Harry Turtledove over there.
We don't, but I know the kind of literature you're talking about, the kind of thing where you might, yes, create a correspondence between two historical characters, but it's for a fictional purpose.
Yeah, sure. Now, we can't be absolutely certain that many of these documents were intended to be taken as authentic, as opposed to being simply thought experiments. Now, this is a very broad thing, but you can't simply just say guilt by association, therefore the works of Tacitus were interfered with. You have to have some evidence that the works of Tacitus were interfered with. Now, all we have, really, and I've noticed this on Ken's website, is he says that there was a particular point where the word Christians, as spelled C-H-R-E, was changed to C-H-R-I by scribes. Well, that's not a difficult issue. The scholars are aware of it, and we know what the answer to that is. It was simply a matter of scribes perhaps doing a little textual criticism of their own, thinking that perhaps someone along the line had miscopied and misspelled the word Christians, and fixing it with the I rather than the E. This is a normal textual critical answer. There's no need to go further into conspiracy. And it is noteworthy as well that when Tacitus mentions Christus just previously, he spells it with the I, and there is no dispute about that word.
Okay, I mean, we're majoring on Tacitus, and perhaps we'll keep going on that. I'd like to come to the Gospels as well, because I think, if you like, they are the primary source for most people who don't delve into the history too much, so it would be worth doing that as well. But but essentially, I mean, KP is saying, where's your evidence on the Tacitus front that this was meddled with by over-eager Christians, Ken?
Yeah. Can I respond to the comment of use of conspiracy? I'm not suggesting there's a conspiracy. Yeah? I'm suggesting there's certainly a tendency throughout the whole history of Christianity to embellish the doctrines and the sacred texts. There's a tendency to put in what they would like to see, and we can see that shown in the manuscript evidence of marginal notes then being written into the body of the text. We can see how the text has been improved to meet with what people thought should be there. Now, I gave several examples of forgery, but we could go on and give several others. One that I will mention, I won't bother with too many others, but you know, the first canon list, so-called after Muratori, you know, in the lists, actually has the comment, there is in circulation an epistle to the Laodiceans and another to the Alexandrians forged under the name of Paul. Now, that is not quibbling about misunderstanding. That is a clear statement from an Orthodox text making clear that there were forgeries at that stage. So, we're not into a conspiracy here. What we are into is the creation of a myth which has been perpetuated through generations. Now, if we want to look at Tacitus in more detail, let's do so, because I'm happy to do that, because I think here is an example of a very famous paragraph in Tacitus, which Christians use an awful lot, but in actual fact has great question marks hanging over it.
Okay, give us this passage and why you doubt it then.
Well, as JP will know, he's referring to something that appears in the annals of Tacitus. I think it's in book 15, where he basically talks about Nero fastening the guilt of the fire that had affected Rome on the Christians. Now, you know, it's a very lurid and well-written couple of paragraphs about the, you know, and everyone is familiar with this very, you know, memorable scene of the torch Christians decorating Tacitus' garden, so-called. But, you know, I find that questionable simply because if we look back to the other history of Tacitus written earlier, that is the histories in book 5, where he actually discusses the Jews particularly, he makes no mention of the Christians. He makes no mention of this, you know, notorious torching of Christians by Nero in his garden. You know, so we can go through it phrase by phrase if we felt it was necessary, but I think, you know, it's salutary to note that this primary witness for the historical Jesus is a passage in a book to which we are indebted to Christians who are known to make forgeries, and we can see evidence there immediately how it looks very questionable.
Now, it looks like it's been inserted.
It looks like it's been inserted, yes.
So it wasn't there to start with. JP?
Okay. This is, again, simply this guilt by association technique, and he's denying, he's saying conspiracy. Well, if you're saying that some Christian doing a forgery in, i.e., the 3rd century, is evidence that some Christian might have done a forgery in, i.e., the 9th century, then conspiracy is really only the only way to establish a connection. It's as though saying there is some cooperative effort by Christians to produce forgeries over an extended period of time. This guilt by association argument will not work.
JP, and
will
do it's the a same. Commitment to
no,
the fact.
No, I will not. I will not allow you to interrupt me, Ken. You will let me finish. Now, this guilt by association argument will not work. It can be turned around just as readily by the Shakespeare people, who say the anti-Stratfordians, as they call them, who say that Shakespeare did not write his works. It can be used to say that Gamaliel did not exist and passages by him were inserted. We can find some Jews who did something wrong in the 13th century and say, well, this proves or helps support the idea that this was inserted into the Talmud. Now, as far as this thing not being mentioned in the histories but being mentioned in the annals, I have a very simple question. Is everything that is written in the histories also mentioned in the annals?
Ken?
I can interrupt here, yeah. Can I?
I'm done now. You may go ahead.
No, of course not.
All right. Now, that's all. Now I will let you go ahead after I say this. Since that is the case, then there is no justification for saying, because this does not appear in the histories, we can suspect that it was inserted into the annals. Unless the annals and the histories are exact parallels for one another, this argument has no basis whatsoever. And now I'm done.
Okay, well, I would say that, yeah, whilst we wouldn't expect both sources to replicate entirely the same material, in certain areas it would be reasonable to expect some support for such ideas. I mean, this episode that is found in Tacitus regarding the fire isn't found anywhere else. It isn't found in Suetonius or any other writer. It isn't found in Josephus. We have this very lurid story, and it isn't found in Tacitus' other references to the Jewish people, and you know, that is why question marks, you know, are raised in no small order over this evidence.
It sounds to me, JP, like this just isn't good enough evidence that there was insertion, that there was change. It's all guilt by association, because other people did it. Okay. It must have happened here.
Yeah, well, all he's done here is say, well, now it doesn't appear in Suetonius and Josephus. And my question is the same. Is everything in Suetonius also in Tacitus's works? Is everything in Josephus? I mean, this is an argument simply contrived. It's like, it must be mentioned in every single place. But I don't see any reason to believe that at all. We're simply being standing back with a gasp and saying, oh my, it's not mentioned there. Yep. This is not significant at all.
The difficulty we have with that, of course, is all these various sources, which, as you say, we shouldn't expect them to replicate each other across the whole field. But what's striking about them all is the absence of references to the historical Jesus. I mean, that is the issue at stake here.
Isn't the problem, though, that if you're demanding this weight of evidence, you're asking that you can't trust any history from the first few centuries that Christians could have had access to? I mean, is that the problem? Aren't you asking a bit much there?
Well, no. To say that we can't trust it would be going too far, but we have to view it with a certain amount of care and caution, particularly where it relates to matters that are so crucial to the faith. Because what these, and I'm sure we could go on to the other half a dozen people that are usually bracketed together, these non-Christian witnesses, is that all those passages are both brief but very powerful. They have the character of looking like an insertion, because so much is said that's so useful to the Christians, and yet all within one paragraph that is neatly slotted into a very different topic. And that is where I think we all should be cautioned.
I mean, are you saying that these people should have been writing whole books about Jesus if he was such an important character?
Well, let's take the easiest example there of Josephus. Why does Josephus say so much about the Christians in one paragraph, and yet the rest of his book he just says nothing about them? I mean, that smacks of an insertion.
JP.
All right, well, I'm not going to deal with Josephus. In fact, someone else wrote my chapter on Josephus for the book I put out. So I'm just going to deal with Tacitus, and let me just ask a yes or no question. Does that brief and powerful description also fit with the idea of Tacitus, in your opinion? Are you going with that as a reason to suppose it's an insertion there?
Are you asking, do I think the language has the right character for Tacitus?
Yes, and the way
I think it does. I think someone who has done that has done it very skillfully.
All right, so this is the clever forger thesis, essentially.
Well, some of them would have been clever forgers, would they not?
How is this disprovable?
Well, I think that's your task, not mine.
Oh, no, you have to tell me, you have to have disproof available or some possible option for disproof, because otherwise we can simply say the same for the passages in the Talmud about Gamaliel.
Well, I defer to your knowledge of those particular passages. I haven't looked at those myself.
All right.
Okay, but when we read any document from the past, we obviously recognize certain possible problems with it, in a sense that the author may have a point of view that he's expressing. He may be trying to please political forces that are his audience. There may be all kinds of considerations. Now, the probability about this lurid passage in Tacitus, I would say the probability is that it is forged. Now, we can't say more than that, and yet, are we going to build our entire religious faith on the questionable reliability of an insertion in in a Roman historian's
just one
book?
More, one more response from you, JP, and then we're going to have to go to a break.
All right, well, religious faith, again, is a separate issue from whether or not a man named Jesus existed and headed the Christian movement. We can work on that later. The only reason I have heard so far that this passage might be a forgery is, A, that it is brief and powerful, which makes me wonder whether other passages in Tacitus are likewise brief and powerful, and otherwise they might be insertions. And second, the item we alluded to about the spelling of the word Christians. And that's all I've heard so far. Now, perhaps we'll have some more reasons given after the break. I have at least 19 or 20 items that Dennis McKenzie once reported supposedly giving reasons why this was a forgery. I'll be interested to see if any of these are picked up.
Well, we would I'd like us, in a way, to get into the Gospels as well, to some extent, in the next section of the programme, though it's been fascinating tussle between you both on this external witness in the form of Tacitus and whether Ken does require more, if you like, proof than is reasonable to ask for, you know, and that whole question of, you know, is this just a undisprovable in the sense of that if it's such a wonderful forgery, Ken, there's no way we could ever possibly prove it to be one way or the other. I mean, it's sort of like, can you ever trust anything in Tacitus if someone could have forged it?
Well, yes, it isn't quite as grim as that. It isn't quite as grim as that. But look, we are, after all, not trying to prove that just any old run-of-the-mill Jesus existed. We are confronted with a character who makes great claims for his presence on Earth and his purpose in humanity's story. I mean, if he was so great, there should have been a residue of his existence.
Let's continue this discussion in just a moment's time. You're listening to Unbelievable here on Premier Christian Radio as my guests Ken Humphreys and JP Holding do battle on the existence of Jesus. Do join us again on the other side of a break. And don't forget, this programme available online at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And don't forget, you can call in too and give your emails as well as response. I'll give you the details for doing that at the start of the next section.
Welcome back to Unbelievable. Before we go back to our discussion here in the studio on the existence of Jesus, let me say that next week we're going to hear an interfaith discussion between Stephen Pasht of Jews for Jesus. He's a Messianic Jew. And Jonathan Romain, he's a rabbi, a reformed rabbi in the Jewish faith. And they're going to be asking, was Jesus the Messiah of the Jews? Very interesting discussion, same time next week between 2:30 and 4.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back, and we're looking at the whole idea of whether Jesus existed. It is, if you like, the hyper-skeptical point of view in many ways, but it's one that's held by Ken Humphreys. He's an atheist critic of Christianity. His website is JesusNeverExisted.com, which pretty much tells you where he stands on the issue. JP Holding has been discussing with him. We've been particularly looking at external witnesses to Jesus' existence, particularly Tacitus in the last part of the programme. You can get JP Holding's thoughts and articles at tectonics.org. That's tectonics spelt with a K. And yes, we're going to be maybe breaching as well in this section of the programme the gospel witness to Jesus as well, and Ken's problems with that and what JP may have to say on that. But ultimately, JP, the point you're making overall is that Ken really is demanding a far higher level of evidence because he says, as he keeps telling us, for Jesus made these claims, if you're going to base a religion on someone, you really need a high level of evidence. And you're saying, well, that's actually mixing up two issues, basically.
Yeah. Again, there's two different levels here. Jesus in human history who led the movement, and there's a Jesus in the Gospels who did all these miracles. Ken's site is called Jesus Never Existed. It is not called Jesus the Wonder Worker of the Gospels Never Existed. If he was simply addressing that issue, then he would have no issue at all with the testimony of Tacitus, because Tacitus doesn't testify that Jesus did any miracles. So let's make it clear, if we're going to discuss did a person named Jesus exist who led the Christian movement, crucified under Pilate, etc., then that is an entirely different issue as to whether Jesus was a miracle worker. Because they could have agreed that he worked miracles, but done like Celsus, attributed it to Egyptian magic or some other such thing. Why would we have someone, like Bart Ehrman,
who agrees that Jesus existed as a person, and he is an agnostic, professed agnostic, but he does not agree, of course, that Jesus did any miracles. And this is, there can't be, you can't say he has some confessional interest because he is an agnostic. And then you say, well, it's left over from the time he was a fundamentalist. Well, I agree he has some leftover fundamentalism in him. But at this point, you have to say, well, what about someone like Robert Price? Obviously, he broke out of that and became objective. Well, now you're simply going to essentially go to an ad hominem against Bart Ehrman. He just can't clear his mind of that one thing.
You're saying that Ken has a very, if you like, presumably he claims Christians have vested interests in you know, putting the record for Jesus in a good light. Are you saying that Ken is equally in the other direction, drawing on the very, very most out there kind of theories and possibilities of history to put this case together?
I don't use people's motives in my arguments unless it's something obvious or unless I want to make a point, which is not very often with that. I mean, my point is that appealing to people's motives and biases and interests is simply a distraction from the evidence. And you can interpret interest in many ways. You can say, well, because they had an interest, they invented a person named Jesus. Well, their interest could also motivate them to report the historically accurate fact that Jesus existed. Motive can cause any number of reactions, whether real ones or fake ones. And so it's really a straw man is what it is. It's a diversion from the evidence to appeal to people's confessional interests or their biases.
I mean, you yourself have admitted, Ken, that you're in a minority position, you know. And the vast majority of biblical scholars out there are not making these kinds of claims.
No.
And then you're putting on them that, well, that's just because there's been such an overriding assumption in the historical fact of Jesus. I mean, we have historians here who aren't kind of, you know, tied to some kind of belief in Christianity, like Bart Ehrman.
We're all on a voyage. I mean, Bart Ehrman has gone from a fundamentalist Christian to this agnostic now, who may still believe in a historical Jesus at this moment in time, but he's still a relatively young man. Maybe in 10 years' time, he'll explain why he lost faith in a historical Jesus. We don't know that yet. We all evolve in our ideas. Hopefully, I certainly have. I mean, I've said this on your show before, Justin. You know, at one stage, if we put the clock back long enough, I would have just said, as everybody else would, oh, there's probably a historical Jesus. Because you can make that comment without fear of contradiction and without one iota of evidence. Now, the point is, I have no axe to grind in whether there was or wasn't a historical Jesus. I simply found that there wasn't. When I started to investigate and tried to find him, I found I couldn't. And I wasn't the first to do that, because scholars have been doing that for 200 years. They've discovered that there is no historical Jesus. That's why some of them, like Rudolf Bultmann, said, give up on the looking for it, concentrate on Christ. You know, okay, let's move the argument on then. I think it is valid to press the point about evidence simply because we are talking about someone for whom at least minimalistic claims have to be made. We're not simply saying he put together a chair or a table because he was a carpenter. We are saying he caused the world to be turned upside down, as the book of Acts puts it. You know, people's lives were transformed, as the apologists always keep telling us. They suffered unto death, so they would maintain, because of this faith. So there supposedly was something there that was more than just another carpenter. Now, that is what I say there is no evidence of. And when we get into the second century witnesses, such as we did with Tacitus, we're really not talking about Jesus at all. We're talking about Christians and the people who had a certain belief system. Now, let's move on to the subject of the Gospels then, because, you know, we have certain problems there. We do not have first-hand copies from eyewitnesses of these extraordinary events. We have the very opposite of that. We don't have any complete Bibles before the 4th century. We have a few fragments from the 3rd, and then various textual references of it in a bewildering variety from the 2nd. Now, all that suggests to me that in the early century, that is probably the 2nd century, there was a struggle for an understanding of what they would interpret to be Jesus and his story and the Christ. And that was a battle of ideas finally resolved in the favour of orthodoxy. And when we look at the Gospels, what we have today is the testimony of the winners in a very acrimonious and violent debate.
JP, is that the way you see the way that the New Testament canon has come to us?
No, and I'm going to briefly comment on those last points before I go into the Gospels.
Go ahead.
We'll see Bart Ehrman in 10 years. Well, G.A. Wells changed over away from the idea that Jesus didn't exist, so maybe in 10 years we'll see Ken Humphreys change his mind as well, and we'll use that as a basis.
We'll certainly have him on again if that happens.
I suppose so. Inevitably, though, again, if this is just... We could use some of these same arguments that he's using about the Gospels and turn them around and use them for Gamaliel. We don't have any first-hand copies of the Talmud. We can see a struggle between the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the Essenes and these other Jewish groups happening. And we can say that Gamaliel was invented by the Pharisees to give themselves legitimacy. I mean, when it comes to this kind of idea, you can suggest anything you want to in order to come up with some reason why there was some sort of tampering done. And so, this is simply it's contrived methodology in history. It's not based on evidence. It's based on a presupposition that something has happened, and we need to find out what.
I would comment on that the presupposition is on your own part, JP. I mean, you are a committed Christian. You take pride in being the hardest-hitting apologist and the rest of it. I mean, I have already confessed the fact that my opinion changed. I thought there was an historical Jesus until I tried to find the evidence of one. I'm not dogmatic on the point. If in 10 years' time I find evidence for an historical Jesus, I'll be very happy to come on this show and explain why. But the problem is I'm not seeing them. I'm not hearing them from you. You know, I'm hearing defences, but I don't hear any strong evidence here for an historical Jesus. And we have a much more plausible explanation for why in the second century there was such factional division in the Christian movement. There were so many contending factions and heresies because they didn't know what to believe until it was hammered out. And then it became authorised in their various Gospels that are now in the book we have today.
JP?
Now, these are very vague summary statements that really don't make an argument for anything whatsoever. And if we want to, again, I don't play the game of confessional interest or bias or what have you, saying, I'm a committed Christian, well, Bart Ehrman is not, and therefore then what? Well, he was brainwashed and he's still brainwashed now, etc. We could just as easily say, and this is said tongue-in-cheek, well, Ken has a website and he's trying to sell a book and he's trying to sell T-shirts and mugs or what have you, and therefore he has a reason to defend this point of view. I'm not actually saying that's why he's doing it. But if we want to play this game of he has an interest, he has a bias, that's why he's defending it, again, it's simply a diversion from the evidence. Now, we're talking here about different views of the Gospels. I like what he said about history is written by the winners. I remember Dan Brown saying something like that. My general reply, polemically speaking, is, yes, it's written by the winners and complained about by the losers. But let's see. What we have in terms of these fractions...
The losers are dead, actually.
So are the winners, for that matter, in many ways. But let's say, if you want to talk about, say, the Gospels in particular, we don't have first-hand copies, no, and we don't have first-hand copies of any of these ancient works, and yet I've yet to see any historian or any scholar make an issue of this for any secular work. We don't have first-hand copies of any of the works of Confucius. We don't have first-hand copies of any African poems written by some of their ancient people. This is simply not an issue, and that's why we do textual criticism.
I mean, on that basis, I've often heard it said that, in fact, while people like Ken may make some issue about we only have later copies, in fact, the copies we have are dated a lot earlier than many of the manuscripts we have for evidence of other great historical characters. We have closer and better manuscripts than many other historical characters.
Well, yeah, now we don't have time to get all into all the details. That's in my next book. But if you're going to make comparative claims, then if you're going to throw out the New Testament, and you're going to have to throw out every other major historical work from the ancient world, including Tacitus, including Livy, including Suetonius, and including the Talmud. It's all going to become a blank slate, and we may as well adhere to the thesis that history actually started with the Roman Empire and the Middle Ages were a fraud, which is a real thesis, by the way.
So there's the problem then, surely, Ken, that if you're discounting the Gospels because we only have later copies, we don't have the originals, and then you're kind of denying us any history.
No, 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 no. I mean, we get the danger of creating a caricature here. Let me answer part of what JP has said here by referring to something, it used to be a standard comment in my emails from Christians that there is as much evidence of Jesus as there is for Julius Caesar. Now, I heard that so often, I did write an article specifically on Julius Caesar to illustrate how we can have a great deal of confidence, in fact, complete confidence that Julius Caesar existed, because of the mass of interlocking and mutually supportive evidence. Now, that's different when we come to someone like Jesus. We don't have a mass of interlocking and mutually supporting evidence. We have evidence of generations of doctrinal disputes. We have the Gospels from the Marcions. We have the Gospels from the Docetists. We have, you know, evidence of all manner of heresies that, you know, strangely enough, emerge very early on in this so-called religion. And, you know, it's less plausible that the pure doctrine suddenly metamorphosed into 80 or 100 heresies than in actual fact the truth is probably that out of that whole ocean of religious thinking, certain ideas crystallize and eventually were given official form in the faction that happened to then manage to cement itself into the Roman political system.
And are you saying that the Gospels then are effectively the crystallised thoughts and traditions that won the day, if you like?
Indeed I do. And you know, if we have time, we can trace through, you know, let's take the very basic fact that we know about the Synoptic Gospels, that Matthew and Luke are based upon Mark. Now, most scholars, I don't know if JP does, but most scholars will agree that is the case. Now, what is the relationship there? Mark wasn't one of the disciples. He has not claimed to be an eyewitness. And yet Matthew supposedly was one of the disciples and an eyewitness. Why does Matthew, an eyewitness, copy the text provided by a non-witness? I mean, that's the sort of nonsense that you have if you try and take the official story as being valid. What we have in Mark, in its original form, was a much shorter gospel. It had nothing about the birth of Jesus. It had nothing about the resurrection appearances, a very brief document, which in Matthew and in Luke was embellished and developed into a much more comprehensive doctrine.
I feel like we're opening a whole new area here. Surely. And unfortunately we're already approaching near the end of the show, so I'll allow JP to respond and then we may have to start to wind things up.
Okay. There's not much. I do have articles on each of those issues that he's mentioned. My article on the virgin birth covers the issue of Mark not mentioning it. In terms of the Mark and priority queue thesis, I do adhere to Matthean priority. I have a great detailed articles on that. But
what do you mean by that? Just for those who may not understand
quite
well.
It means that Matthew wrote first, or I believe it was written in Aramaic or Hebrew first, and Mark wrote later or at a different time independently of Matthew. Both are based on the common oral tradition that the apostles.
Okay, so both Mark and Matthew both depended on an earlier source.
Yeah,
so it's not Matthew copying Mark; it's them both copying an earlier source, and Matthew incorporating that into his eyewitness account.
Right, oral tradition, and Luke, I do think, had hold of an early form of Matthew and of Mark. Now, I'll just go back for this topic to the issue of Julius Caesar. I have an article on that too, and there's a lot of issues involved in that, like. It's usually connected to Caesar crossing the Rubicon in the analogies I've seen. And there's some question, do you mean Caesar crossing it personally, like stepping over the river himself, or does that mean his army crossing and so on? And what I concluded is that this is not really a good analogy to use for Jesus. The better analogy was someone like Gamaliel or Socrates, who was a teacher, not a military leader, not someone who is a great force in government, because that does not describe Jesus adequately, especially not as the pagan writers would have seen him. And this is a critical mistake that's often made, and I've seen it on Ken's website as well. He asks why various people like Appian or Plutarch don't mention Jesus. Well, again, we have this confusion between Jesus as a person and Jesus as a miracle worker. When you have someone like Plutarch, let's say he hears about Jesus for the first time. Well, he's not going to be willing to grant that this Jewish peasant who was shamefully crucified was actually someone who did miracles. He's simply going to dismiss that as an unworthy story without any further investigation and not report it. And so we can't be expecting these authors to adopt the viewpoint of the Christians, as it were. Otherwise, they would be Christian sources if they agreed that Jesus did all these miracles. Or they'd be like Celsus and say, well, he was a magician of some kind, learned his craft in Egypt. The practice, again, we need to compare to comparable figures like Gamaliel, like Socrates, like Confucius, who were teachers with a circle of disciples. We would mostly expect the followers to provide the information about that person. As with Socrates, Plato, Xenophon, mostly his followers wrote about him. With Gamaliel, we have mostly the Talmud. In the case of the New Testament, that's what we would expect the most information to come from Jesus. Now, we obviously don't have time to get into these ideas of fractions and different heresies and whatnot, and I suppose there's no way to really sum it up simply. But, you know, if at some point you could discuss the specific heresies and whatnot. But again, this is all very broad and vague as we have it right now. And I continue to maintain that this is simply a matter of inventing rules as we go along, simply in order to dispose of Jesus as a real person.
Fascinating discussion, gentlemen, and I wish we had more time to delve into some of the aspects of this, but it is a huge area, as I said right out at the beginning. And, well, if you want to visit Ken or JP's site, you will be able to delve to your heart's content into some of the various aspects of what we've been talking today and beyond. Let me just give you the website addresses again. JP Holding, our Christian on the program today. You can find his articles and thoughts at tectonics.org, tectonics with a K. And Ken Humphreys, jesusneverexisted.com. So we're going to come back to you, gentlemen, just for some final thoughts from you both as we conclude the program. If you're listening and you'd like to respond yourself, then you're more than welcome to get in touch with the program. Do drop me an email via unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Or if you prefer to phone and leave a comment via voicemail, you're welcome to do that on 08456 52 52 52. Select option 5 there. Do also check out the Unbelievable webpage. This show going live now as a podcast to listen back to there, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. I'll be posting links to my guests' websites as well and to any other relevant shows in the Unbelievable archive as well, which you may be interested in listening back to as well. So it's all there, and you can even now, we've got a special little button that we've added in the last couple of weeks where you can subscribe via iTunes if you like to listen to the podcast that way. It's all possible now. The page again is premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Do tell your very intelligent friends who listen to this program, I know, and I'm sure they'll want to hear this particular debate right there, premier.org.uk/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
OK, gentlemen, just time for a quick wrapping up, just a couple of minutes each, if you don't mind. And we'll let you go first, Ken, and then we'll have JP to finish us off. I mean, one thing that's come through time and time again from JP, Ken, is you're not being fair. You're asking a different level and a different level of, if you like, hyper-scepticism in regard to the evidence for Jesus that you're not demanding for other similar characters of a similar nature of the time, Gamaliel and others, and this just won't do. We're not asking the question, did Jesus perform various miracles and rise from the dead? We're just asking, did Jesus exist? And on that level, the vast majority of historians agree.
I think, yes, many historians would say that. They choose their words very, very carefully when they do. We are not concerned here with establishing just any old person. That is the crucial thing. We would probably want, we don't even have to look at the historical record if we want to conclude there was someone in Nazareth called Jesus. I mean, we can say, well, given the frequency of the name, there were always, often going to be people. We know that Josephus mentions a whole bunch of people called Jesus. So if you just want to be comfortable with the idea there was someone around called Jesus, I don't have any problem with that. There were hundreds of them, thousands of them called Jesus. What we're trying to establish is a particular person. Now, what marks that particular person out from the rest? It is these very things you say now that don't matter. It was the fact that he worked miracles. It was the fact that he raised the dead. You know, if he did none of those things, we wouldn't even be talking about him today. Now,
but I mean, surely though, it's also he was, had a trial under Pontius Pilate, he was crucified. Those aspects of the story are what mark out the Jesus we're talking about. We're not talking about some random Jesus.
There are difficulties in believing they are, you know, historical events. They conform to nothing that would be appropriate for the time and circumstance. You know, I think, and I mean, we have run out of time, but I think what we have here is evidence, but not evidence of an historical Jesus. We have evidence of an evolving myth. And that's what we can demonstrate in great detail without many special pleading. We don't have special pleading. We can see how ideas at one stage were embellished and developed into more elaborate ideas at another. And we could go through verses of the Passion narrative. We could go through any number of stories from the Gospel to show that how from the original Markian version, we got the later, more embellished versions, until the point at which even the post-resurrection appearances were put back at the end of Mark as a sort of addendum. You know, so we can see how there's been cross currents of development. And in actual fact, at least I can appeal to the broad brush idea of most scholars when I put give Mark precedence, because very few people will agree with JP about Matthean precedence nowadays.
All right. Well, thank you very much for being on the programme today. You've presented a very interesting case this afternoon, Ken. I'm sure it's given much food for thought for people.
Hard-hitting, I hope.
Hard-hitting, certainly hard-hitting. And thank you, JP, for your hard-hitting response as well. So, yes, your final analysis, JP, if you would.
I don't really need to add a whole lot. I think it's been demonstrated that this is the case for J&E simply is based on making new rules as you go along that would not be applied to anyone else. And this whole question of, you know, is it this Jesus, the one that did this or that, I have some information for you, Ken. The domain name Jesus, the guy who worked miracles, didn't exist.com is available if you want to make use of that. But you might want to abandon Jesus never existed.com if you want to go in that direction.
Well, I will as soon as you supply me with some evidence.
It's all over the site. Have fun.
Well, JP, thank you very much for joining us as well. It's been fascinating getting your input as well on this. Yes, if people want more, I mean, tell us a little bit about your site and what the kind of materials on there are that people will be able to access.
Oh, good heavens. Well, if you go to the front page, I have over 1,500 articles, essentially. I have book reviews. I have things on doctrine. I have things on the literature aspect. I have a little on Old Testament, not too much. I have some stuff on some historical issues, social science issues, even extended things like the Inquisition a bit. And I do some stuff on Mormonism and some of the other cults as well.
Well, thank you very much for being on the program today. And I'm sure our paths will cross again at some point. Thank you, the listener, for listening. Whether you're a regular listener or this might be your first time listening to Unbelievable, this is the forum where Christians and non-Christians get together. Pretty hard-hitting, heavyweight stuff a lot of the time. I mean, we've gone to a pretty, you know, high-level, historical level here. But I think that's appropriate and right, because people like Ken, with their websites that are now so easily accessible on the internet, you don't have to go to a library to look this stuff up. It's available in your front room. Are making bold claims, and it's important to know where the arguments lie on both sides. I hope you've had an interesting encounter with those arguments during the course of the programme today. Thanks again to both my guests, JP and Ken. Don't forget you can get this programme online now, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And if you haven't subscribed to our podcast, either via some kind of podcast reader or via iTunes, do that, and you'll be able to access a vast back archive of programmes that I'm sure will spark your interest too. Once again, the place to do it, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Well, it's time to wrap this programme up and let you know what's coming up on the programme next week. You're unbelievable. It's an interfaith discussion as we ask, was Jesus the Messiah of the Jews? No question that he existed next week, but a very different interpretation about what Jesus was and who he was. It's going to be Rabbi Jonathan Romain, he's our Jewish guest, and a Messianic Jew in the form of Stephen Pasch. It's going to be a fascinating discussion. Do join me for that at the same time between 2:30 and 4, and online at premier.org.uk/unbelievable.